Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. And on this Wednesday, before Christmas Eve, the story of one man's Christmas treasure he found buried for nearly a century behind the wall of his apartment. Plus, one historian says Ronald Reagan himself wrote the playbook for today's anti-establishment Republicans. And two of the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists whose work is the subject of the acclaimed real-life story Spotlight on the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. But we begin with the so-called Islamic State, close to losing control of Ramadi in Iraq. Now, Ramadi is just 55 miles from Baghdad, and since May, it's been the southernmost town in Iraq under ISIS control. It's the capital of Anbar province, the site of many, many battles during the Iraq War. The Iraqi government and its American backers have considered retaking Ramadi a major objective. But the apparent victory that's close at hand here, taking back Ramadi, is colored by a lot of complexities, the first of which is the question of who is taking back Ramadi. In April, I spoke to Vice Correspondent David Enders. He had just returned from the Sunni city of Ramadi. Even then, he said locals were concerned about Shia fighters entering the city.
That dynamic with having the very obviously sectarian militias that are fighting on behalf of the Iraqi government present in Ramadi, and some of them are present in Anbar already, backing up what the Iraqi army, quote-unquote, which often their units have a very open sectarian bent as well.
Again, that was back in April, and that worry that Shiite militias would punish Sunni civilians in Ramadi may now be a real risk. When another Iraqi city, Tikrit, was wrenched back from the Islamic State last spring, Shiite units were accused of atrocities there. So far, the United States has insisted that no Shiite militia fighters are taking part in the offensive for Ramadi. Instead, the mission is being hailed as an opportunity for the U.S.-trained government forces and Sunni Iraqi soldiers to win an important victory and prove that the Iraqi army, controlled from Baghdad, can fight and win. But many observers are highly skeptical of that claim, and among them, Michael Pregent. He's an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute and a former U.S. Army intelligence officer in Iraq. He served as an intelligence advisor to General David Petraeus there. Michael Pregent, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You are counted as one of the severe skeptics, I would say, of the claim that no Shiite militias have joined the Iraqi army in the fight for Ramadi. Why all the doubt?
The Iraqi army was a sectarian force a year ago, and I don't see what moderating event took place to change that dynamic at all. If you look at the photos used by the Wall Street Journal today to talk about the Ramadi offensive, there are Shia flags in the column. There are clearly militia in that formation of vehicles getting ready to go into Ramadi. The very concern that Sunnis have to begin with is that Shia militia will decide what happens in Ramadi after it's cleared. I understand there are 6,000 Sunnis in there, but you have to understand how this works. There are 6,000 Sunni, but the Shia militia popular mobilization unit structure will have primacy over those fighters.
Michael Pregent, it's hard to, of course, tease out individual fighters, who they're fighting for, and where their loyalties really lie. But one thing that's for sure is that when the coalition building and the fight against ISIS started, it was really assumed from the beginning that a patchwork of Shia militias from all over Iraq, from different cities with different loyalties, were going to be part of the coalition joining with the government that fought against the Sunni ISIS force, and that their backing by Iran was going to be a factor here. I mean, everybody's known this all along, right?
Yes, and we know it to this day. The Pentagon, the White House, and State Department will acknowledge that Shia militias are in Baghdad. They're in Fallujah. They'll say that the Fallujah is actually a Shia militia operation. They'll admit that they're in Karma, which is just to the east of Ramadi.
All right, Michael Pregent, but it also seems like Baghdad may have an important incentive here. Whether there are members of Shiite militias fighting inside or alongside the Iraqi army here or not, and I think we agree that there probably are, if they retake Ramadi from ISIS and the battle is won, it seems like Baghdad has an important incentive to prevent the kind of atrocities and revenge killings that you're talking about. And if they can do that, it could be a real proof of concept.
Baghdad isn't a rule of law government. I'm sorry to say that. Prime Minister Abadi, under immense pressure, he is under immense pressure from Shia militias in Iran. He turned down a special operations package and an Apache 64 package that Secretary Ash Carter was going to present to Iraq. He turned it down because the Shia militias didn't want it. Prime Minister Abadi says all the right things until he's pressured not to. All of his actions are based on the influence of Shia political parties, militias, and Iran. We've had 18 months to build a Sunni force to retake Mosul. We have not. We had 18 months of warning that Ramadi was going to fall. Prime Minister Abadi did nothing to stop that from happening.
Well, as forces move to try to retake Ramadi in Iraq from the Islamic State, the world is watching to see the aftermath of that battle and whether Iraqi forces, along with or including Shiite militias, can win the battle without resorting to human rights violations. Michael Pregent, former U.S. military intelligence officer and advisor to David Petraeus, thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
The U.S. military has until the end of the year, just a few more days actually, to come up with a plan for how they'll open up all combat roles to women. Earlier this month, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter announced that combat positions, including in the military's elite fighting forces, would be open to qualified women by April of next year.
They'll be able to serve as Army Rangers and Green Berets, Navy SEALs, Marine Corps Infantry, Air Force Parajumpers, and everything else that was previously open only to men.
Lieutenant General David Barno was senior American commander of the U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan from 2003 until 2005. Today, he's a distinguished practitioner in residence at American University's School of International Service. Before he retired, Lieutenant General Barno commanded a brigade that included hundreds of women. I visited the general in his Washington, D.C. office recently, and he says that as long as the services maintain their high standards for combat roles, the armed forces will only improve by including women.
They're looking at the psychological screening. They're looking at what they can do physically. They're looking at their mental abilities, blending these all together, maintaining a very tough standard. If they can get in and do that and become part of the team, you're not going to have any issues with cohesion. And those teams form around the people that are there. I commanded a brigade of about 2,000 soldiers. It was 20% women. And I watched units that had just integrated women in form the same kind of high-powered teams that I saw in units that were all male. So it's all about building around those teams of individuals coming together to accomplish a task.
What have we learned from other recent cases of integration? The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell comes immediately to mind. What have we learned through that process or other similar processes that are going to inform how to proceed here?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I can recall a lot of the pushback before the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and I got involved in some heated email debates about that with some people that are pretty knowledgeable, and there were strong arguments that this was going to disrupt these units. We've seen 0.00 of that across the force in the last 2 years. So I think that's instructive here. Bringing women in is not the same. But again, if we maintain the standard, if we build teams that are working together from the beginning to get the mission accomplished, I'm confident that these are going to be better units at the end of the day.
I want to read, you've probably read this, the RAND Corporation did a study of about 7,000 special operators. Some 85% of the respondents said they oppose opening the special operations jobs to women, and some 70% oppose having women in their individual units. More than 80% said women aren't strong enough. What does it mean to this effort if a vast majority of the men who are already doing these highly secret, highly demanding, very respected jobs in the special operations units just don't want it?
Well, I'd say two things about that. Number one, I think if I went back and I surveyed the fighter pilot community 20 years ago before we integrated women into fighter squadrons in the Navy and the Air Force, I would have gotten the exact same polling numbers. Women weren't tough enough. This is a man's job. This is physically demanding that they're not going to be able to meet the standards. We found none of that to be the case. The second observation would be that virtually everybody you're talking to in this study serves in male-only units. They have no experience of serving in a unit that was an integrated between men and women that were performing tough battlefield tasks out there. There are a lot of those units out there today. They're engineer units. So I think they're going to find they're going to be a better unit. They're going to be more effective, and they're going to have a broader insight into some of the really complex gray zone challenges in warfare that these units themselves are facing today and are struggling with right now.
I spent a lot of time covering the Hill, so I've covered a lot of the debates with Senator Gillibrand and others, Senator McCaskill, over sexual assault in the military. You've written in the press that a move like this should actually help with a rampant culture of sexual abuse and sexual assault in the military. A lot of people intuitively have the opposite view, that if you throw people together, it's an environment that might lead to those types of assaults. You say the opposite.
I don't think you can have it both ways. We have, quote unquote, thrown those people together now across 80% of all the jobs in the military, and we've done that for 20 plus years. I don't think the results of that have said that this has now worsened the problem somehow or another. If we have a military that was only men or only women, we'd still have this problem in same-sex challenges. I'm confident, again, from my own experience out there, watching units integrate and leading a force as a colonel that was 20% women, that units that have got women in there that are made part of the team have fewer problems than those that have got women on the outside looking in. So I actually think from a cultural standpoint, this will be beneficial to the military as a whole. If every unit has women, if every unit understands women are part of the team, women aren't some outside entity out there they have no contact, no dealings with, this is going to build stronger teams, and I think that'll help protect against some of these egregious problems.
So what's going on with the Marines? Let's talk about the Marines for 1 second, because they were, and maybe this doesn't surprise people, the Marines were the branch that reacted to this immediately and sort of said to the Secretary of Defense, there are certain jobs where we just don't want this. Now, of course, they were overruled because the Secretary of Defense and the President had been clear. But what's going on at the Marines? What are those jobs that they don't want to include women in? And what does it say about Marine culture? And will they be able to accommodate this decision?
Well, they'll certainly be able to accommodate it. The Marines are incredibly effective. They've got amazingly capable leaders, and they will charge this hill just like they charge every other successfully. I'm not sure how to actually handicap their thinking on how they looked at this. I find it interesting that the Army has machine gunners, the Army has recon specialists, and the Army has fire support specialists, and the Navy and the SEAL community has people that do those things and more, yet neither the SEAL community, the Army Special Ops Ranger or Special Forces community, or the Army Infantry community, you know, elected to, you know, decide to ask for an exception to the policy to have women ruled out. So, I mean, part of it's the culture. The other services have a lot more women in them, so their culture's a bit different. But at the end of the day, the Secretary made his decision, and I'm confident the Marines are going to move out on this and take the objective like they do every other one they're given.
Caveats are important. You don't implement a decision like this without good data. What are some of the things to watch out for? I mean, to a lot of people, it's a no-brainer, sure, but when you're planning a unit of warfighters, you don't move too quickly. You don't do anything that undermines a combat capability. So if you were the one, you know, sitting at the drafting table, I guess, mapping out how this goes, what do you watch out for?
I think two things. Number one is you want to make sure those standards stay in place, and you want to make sure that they're administered objectively without regard to whether men or women are going through the evaluation. So the Army, I think, did a superb job in how they approached this with Ranger School. I got down there to watch that, and I'm very critical on the Army of a lot of things. I think they did this very, very well. I was impressed with what I saw down there. So secondly, I think the services have to be very thoughtful about how they bring women into these units. Finding one or two women who are qualified and putting them in a battalion of 800 Marine infantrymen is not a great idea. And the services have learned this as they've integrated ships in the Navy and submarines in the Navy. So what they want to do is they need to collect a number of qualified women who've gotten through the training and then bring them in together with officers, non-commissioned officers, and junior soldiers in a tranche so that there's a critical mass that arrives at the unit at the same time.
Lieutenant General David Barno, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Lieutenant General David Barno, Senior American Commander of U.S. and Coalition Forces in Afghanistan from 2003 until 2005, now a distinguished practitioner in residence at American University School of International Service. It's The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry. Republican candidates continue their crisscrossing of the country this week, and despite their differences, they're flying under one banner.
I've evolved on many issues over the years, and you know who else has is Ronald Reagan evolved on many issues.
That's Donald Trump back in the first GOP debate, comparing his evolution on issues like abortion and his past support of Democrats to Ronald Reagan. Trump has revived Reagan's campaign slogan with his Make America Great Again trucker hats, and like Reagan, he's gained support among white blue-collar voters. But Reagan, just like Trump, was despised by the Republican establishment of his day. A Republican senator told the New York Times in 1975 during Reagan's challenge to President Gerald Ford, quote, "A Reagan nomination and the crushing defeat likely to follow could signal the beginning of the end of our party as an effective force in American life." Sound familiar? Listen to Republican Senator and former presidential candidate Lindsey Graham of South Carolina on CNN back in August.
Donald Trump is not going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. If he is, That's the end of the Republican Party.
Rick Perlstein is a national correspondent for The Washington Spectator and author of Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. And he joins me now. Welcome, Rick.
Very pleased to be here.
Well, I just played that clip from Lindsey Graham, who, as we reported yesterday, is no longer in the race. So maybe that tells us all we need to know. But Ronald Reagan heard similar accusations and similar sort of foreboding in the mid-70s to his own candidacy, didn't he?
Yes, and then before that, he heard the similar forebodings in the mid-1960s when he ran for governor. And then he did something very unprecedented. He announced that he was going to run against an incumbent president of his own party, Gerald Ford, for the 1976 nomination. And he came very, very close. It's kind of a forgotten story. Gerald Ford pulls it out, and the New Yorker says, well, that's it for Ronald Reagan's political career. And he really, you heard that, you know, almost through the presidential election in 1980. I learned from a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter that they were absolutely convinced that all it would take to finish Ronald Reagan once and for all was to get him on that debate stage with Jimmy Carter. Ronald Reagan was widely seen to have won the debate, and that was a week before the election, and he ended up with a landslide. And, of course, served two terms. And now he's, you know, we talk about the age of Reagan.
And so now it seems, at least in certain parts, Donald Trump is kind of repeating some of the Reagan playbook, certainly an appeal to blue-collar, white, middle-class voters. Has he been reading up on Reagan's political strategy here? Do you think it's a carbon copy in that way?
He's certainly very specifically referred to a phrase of Richard Nixon's, which is that he's the candidate of the silent majority. In other words, that kind of gut level, middle American sense that, you know, we are the backbone of the country and you might not hear about us because, you know, the liberals are controlling the media, but wait until we get our voice and we're going to be roaring. And of course, Ronald Reagan picked up on that same theme. And his appeal to blue-collar white voters had a lot to do with the sense that their world was being usurped by minorities, by people on welfare, by protesters, and all the rest. And, of course, it proved extraordinarily successful.
Help us remember the state of the Republican Party in 1976 when Ronald Reagan first ran and lost and then set himself up to win in 1980. How did he accomplish a primary, and what was his message right then?
Well, it was far worse, according to the pundits, than it is now. There was a poll taken by Ford's pollster showing that only 18% of the country was identifying themselves as Republicans at the time. You know, it was after Watergate. And it's really fascinating how long this kind of discourse that the Republican Party was going to go the way of the Whigs, literally that there might not be a Republican Party for the presidential election in 1978. And interestingly enough, the reason given for why the Republican Party was so weak and so vulnerable was that the conservatives were taking it over. What the kind of pundits didn't understand was that the conservatives were motivating voters and issues that had not been part of the political process before. They were adding people to the political process through issues like abortion, opposition to gay rights through gun control and things like that.
You know, Rick Perlstein, a lot of the dynamics that you describe during Ronald Reagan's rise, people have tied the Reagan strategy to the success that Donald Trump is having, but I'm hearing a lot more similarities with the argument Ted Cruz is making for the nomination. Ted Cruz is asked, you're so conservative, how can you win? You can never win being so far right. His answer is, millions and millions of real conservatives stayed home because they're disaffected. I can win on a wave of conservative support. It doesn't have to be moderates. Yes. I don't need the broad middle.
And that's always kind of been an abiding fantasy of the conservative movement and the Republican Party. You know, they always say that. And sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But I certainly don't see any objective evidence for what Ted Cruz is saying. But there's a certain kind of almost messianic faith that conservatives have, that they're so right that they can't possibly lose. And that can be a real advantage when it comes to the kind of energy that it takes to win an election. But it can be a real disadvantage when it comes to kind of sober assessments of the electoral situation, as we saw in Romney's case, in which, you know, basically you had the unskewing the polls movement, in which they argued that the polls were all wrong and maybe Romney would win. And of course, that didn't bear itself out in any event.
And so with all of the clamor to claim Ronald Reagan's mantle, his legacy, his name, his message, you see it all over the Republican field. And we understand why. He's a respected and celebrated figure of the right and of Republicanism. Is there a candidate running now who comes closest to the Reagan vision? And if the answer is yes, you know, this is 2015, right. Not 1980. Should they want to have the Reagan mantle, or do they need something new?
You know, we're beginning to see that actually break up in the Republican Party. Very interestingly, Bill O'Reilly wrote a book called Killing Reagan that has all the Reagan dieharders apoplectic with rage because he suggests that, you know, Reagan was incapacitated in his second term as president. So we're beginning to see that particular fever break. Both Cruz and Walker, who, of course, is no longer in the race, come very much out of that conservative movement and conservative infrastructure that was built around the Goldwater and Reagan campaign. The Trump campaign is not part of that infrastructure. So even though he, you know, has that kind of charisma that is kind of attracting voters like Reagan did, he certainly does not kind of claim obeisance to the alpha and the omega of the conservative movement's ideological agenda. So Reagan may not be as relevant to this election as the Republicans would hope.
Rick Perlstein is national correspondent for The Washington Spectator. Rick, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Rick Perlstein is also author of Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Richard Nixon, and The Rise of Reagan.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you. Before you rack up too much credit card debt this holiday season, here's an inside look at a system designed to favor debt collectors and disable consumers. When debt gets too old or can't be collected, banks sell it, not piece by piece, but in huge volumes, thousands of unpaid bills at a time, often decades old. That debt is often sold to third-party debt collectors who then use the court system to collect those debts. But that court system itself isn't a place where consumers can fight back. It's, in a word, rigged by the law itself. Peter Holland is a consumer rights lawyer in Maryland who's been following the debt collection industry for years, and he joins me now. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Take a second and walk me through how big volumes of thousands of unpaid bills can be churned and turned into what I'm led to understand is a $100 billion a year industry of debt collection.
What happens primarily with credit card debt, but now it's happening with student loan debt and car loans and things of that nature, is after a certain period of time, a bank, if they have, say, $100 million worth of credit card receivables outstanding, they get to tell the regulators and their investors that, you know, they're looking really good, they're looking healthy, they're owed $100 million. What happens, though, is the IRS says that after 180 days of an account not getting paid, suddenly that account can no longer be considered an asset, an account receivable. Now it switches over to a liability. And so what has developed over the past couple of decades is this whole secondary market called the debt buying market, where banks, as you said, will just package and bundle debts and sell them to investors, debt buyers, who are literally buying an interest in a claim. The problem that has developed is that the banks and the debt buyers have gotten together and said, we're going to sell you not only our good accounts, but we're also going to perhaps be selling some of the not so good accounts. And some of the accounts that we're selling may include accounts that were already discharged in bankruptcy, accounts that have already been settled, accounts that are the result of identity theft, and accounts that we don't have the documentation to prove either that the person actually owes it or that the amount owed is accurate.
So, Peter Holland, a lot of the claims may be legitimate. A lot of them may be erroneous. But then what happens when these debt collectors turn around to collect, let's say, $4,000, $5,000 from a consumer, from Joe Smith or Mary Jones, who they say owes them money? What happens?
Debt buyers literally flood the courts. typically, you know, for $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, what most people would call small claims. And the business model is to file them, and they understand that on a $2,000 lawsuit, most people simply aren't going to respond. And the judges feel, you know, judges have reported they feel no option other than I better just sign off. It's a default judgment system.
Peter Holland, this sounds like the kind of situation that's ripe for a countersuit or a class action lawsuit.
The problem is that class actions in this country and in this context are often defeated by forced arbitration provisions in contracts. What it means is that somewhere in the fine print of, say, a credit card contract you had with your bank, it says you have no right to sue us in court. We can sue you in court, but if you want to come after us, you will get no judge, no jury, no right to appeal.
So what's the best recourse here, Peter Holland, for individuals?
What needs to happen in this country is forced arbitration in consumer contracts needs to be eliminated.
A debt collection system in the United States that seems to tilt the power decidedly in the favor of debt collection companies and not consumers. Peter Holland, consumer rights lawyer from Maryland. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Holiday season is Oscar movie time, and one of the most critically acclaimed films of the season is Spotlight.
Mitch, are you telling me that the Catholic Church removed legal documents from that courthouse?
Look, I'm not crazy. I'm not paranoid. I'm experienced. Check the docket. You'll see. They control everything.
Now, the film is based on the true story of the Boston Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting on the pedophile pre-scandal in the Catholic Church. John Hockenberry sat down with two of the reporters who broke that story for the Globe, Michael Resendiz and Sasha Pfeiffer, portrayed in the movie by Mark Ruffalo and Rachel McAdams. They talked about the new movie, the state of investigative journalism, and the real-life challenges they found themselves facing when they took on the Boston Archdiocese and uncovered a story that rocked the church and resonates today.
You know, we knew that we were up against a very powerful and beloved institution. And in many ways, this project was the ultimate reporting challenge because, unlike nonprofits or companies where you can look up some sort of tax documents, or many government agencies where you can send a Freedom of Information Act request and get public records, we couldn't do that with the church. It's protected by the First Amendment. And ultimately, our legal fight against the church said that we believe the public's right to know what's in those files is greater than the church's right to privacy. We ultimately won that fight, but it was a hard fight. So this was a formidable institution to go up against.
So much of this story is psychological and doesn't have clues and crime scenes that you can see. Do you see that psychological piece of it in the movie?
The psychological aspect with the victims presents a reporting problem in a way, because typically a victim of child sex abuse will not come forward until they're an adult, sometimes not until decades after the abuse. So it makes it hard for someone like myself and Sasha to reconstruct the past. And it's also a problem in a legal sense, because your right to sue runs out depending on what state you're living in, depending on the statute of limitations. What was different about our story is we proved that there was a cover-up. We proved that high-level church officials, including Cardinal Bernard Law, knew what was going on and allowed it to go on.
But I think what we want to make sure people realize is that the psychological impact of this is massive and ongoing. I mean, we've been hearing from many victims in past weeks who are only now coming forward decades later. I had someone email me, a grown man, and say, I still wonder, was it something I did that made this happen? Of course it wasn't. It was just the psychology of whatever was wrong with that priest. But people still wrestle with that decades later, and that is a trauma that's hard to recover from.
What about the reporters? Passion to get to the bottom of this here. Is that conveyed? Because it's not necessarily, you know, action movie material.
No, we really wondered when we first heard they wanted to make a movie, how do you make an interesting movie about our jobs, which are largely phone calls, document review, and data entry? But they made it pretty engrossing and kept it authentic. I mean, I think that one of the hardest things about this project was dealing with people who decades later were still locked in time by a trauma that had happened years earlier, decades earlier. But that becomes angering, and anger becomes motivational. And I think that's the effect it had on all of us.
Did the movie take you back to those moments and allow you to relive them, or is this a little bit of a, you know, Hollywoodization?
No, I don't think it's a Hollywoodization at all. I think the movie captures to a remarkable degree the substance and the spirit of what we did. You know, it wasn't always pleasant to be rocketed back in time to 2001. I think for all of us, it was tough. Also, we worked incredibly hard. I mean, we were working 7 days a week, off until 10 o'clock at night. I mean, this was a difficult part of our lives, I think. And
that intense work is why you no longer look like Mark Ruffalo. Right?
That's right. It takes its toll.
Well, you're closer to Rachel McAdams.
But I think, again, it's motivational because we want to make sure that even though we think the church is doing better now than it did decades earlier, there's still work to do. And I think we all hope this movie keeps people vigilant on this issue.
Does this movie celebrate the value of investigative reporting? Does it celebrate the value and importance and heroism of someone coming forth with a story?
Oh, yes.
I think it's those are the two main points that are responsible for the way we feel about this movie. It sends out two messages. One is a message about the importance of investigative reporting, reporters who are dedicated to holding powerful institutions and powerful individuals accountable for what they do. And the other message is to keep the focus on clergy sex abuse because, as Sasha said, there is still so much to be done on that issue. Those are the two main messages of this picture, and that's why we appreciate it so very much.
You know, anybody who pays the slightest attention to the journalism industry knows that the print newspaper business in particular is in very rough financial shape. Newspapers and magazines in particular let you get into a certain kind of depth and detail that is hard to do in any other medium. And there's something truly tragic lost if that is lost.
How did Ruffalo approach you in terms of what he was interested in finding out?
Well, Ruffalo is not only a great, great actor, but he's also a really great reporter. He came to my house to meet me without any fanfare at all. He sat down. He opened a notebook. He took out a pen. He turned on his iPhone. And he started asking me some personal questions. And I was taken aback at first, frankly, and I didn't know how it was going to go. And then I told myself, well, gee, how many times have you done this to other people? And of course, it's probably hundreds. So I decided it was justice and I should relax into the situation and see what happened. And we quickly took off into some very interesting conversations. But we talked all day and a good part of the night. And he also shadowed me at the Globe for several days. And there was a point where I was looking at some video of a botched rescue scene, and Mark literally took over the computer mouse so that we could go back and forth over this video and try to see what went wrong. It was fascinating to watch him watch me, as strange as that may sound.
Well, anyway, this is a great, great moment for both of you, and, you know, fantastic, your success, of course. And what do you think the movie's success means?
Well, I think one thing that I hope it means is that it will give our work, this incredibly important series of stories, a second life. You know, we think we told a story about clergy sex abuse that was very important and remains very important. And we love the fact that that work will live through this movie.
And I hope it brings more respect and love and financial support to newspapers. I think that's really important.
Sasha and Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Resendiz are Boston Globe reporters and the subjects of the acclaimed film Spotlight. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. In an apartment on West 50th Street in New York City, for the past 15 years, acting coach and writer Peter Metagliano has been celebrating Christmas with gifts for two little kids. They're named Mary and Alfred. That's normal enough, but Mary and Alfred aren't his kids or even grandkids or even alive. They're two children who lived in that same apartment more than 100 years ago. Metagliano only knows about the brother and sister because of some letters he discovered in that apartment from Alfred and Mary to Santa Claus. And that opened a window into the past and started a relationship of a kind. Peter Metagliano joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm great. Tell us what you found and how you found it.
Sure. I moved into this apartment 16 years ago, and the fireplace had been bricked up. I think in the 20s, New York made it illegal for coal-burning fireplaces, so they all had to be bricked up. Well, when I moved into the building, I saw that some of my neighbors had opened up the fireplace, put flowers in there or whatever. So I thought, why not, you know, open it up? So my brother, Richard, who is a contractor, I asked him to come over. And before we opened up the fireplace, we were joking around, what are we going to find in there? You know, Westie money, or I said, anything other than bones, it'll be fine. And I did find a coal bill from 1911, and that was pretty much it. So we're cleaning out the stuff, and I'm taking bricks out, and my brother yells into me, "You're not going to believe this." I come in, and he found this piece of white loose leaf paper that you still use today, and it was Little Alfred's note to Santa from 1905. And so we said, well, let's look and see what else might be in here. And sure enough, on a little blue parchment envelope, there was another letter to Santa from his sister written in 1907 to Santa in Reindeer Land. And what was wonderful about it is she had actually made a little handmade stamp and drew a little reindeer on it.
And dated it so that you have the historical record.
Alfred's was written on December 24th, 1905. And Mary's was written on December 24th, 1907.
So what did you do when you found him? What did you say?
Well, to tell you the truth, Alfred's was nice to find. Mary's, when I read her letter, I still remember. I was thunderstruck. It was so touching.
Well, why don't we start with Alfred's? Can you read it for me?
Alfred's was very simple. "Dear Santa Claus, I would like a drum and a hook and ladder with an extensionisting ladder on it."
Extensionisting.
Extensionisting ladder on it. Alfred McGann. And so I said, okay.
Easy enough. A little kid wants a fire truck.
Yes, with an extensionisting ladder.
Okay. Now, you brought Mary's with you, I see. Would you read it for us?
Sure. December 24th, 1907. "Dear Santa Claus, I am very glad that you are coming around tonight. My little brother would like you to bring him a wagon, which I know that you cannot afford. I will ask you to bring him whatever you think best. Please bring me something nice, what you think best. Wishing you a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year from your loving friend, Mary McGann. P.S. Please do not forget the poor." And Todd, when I read that, it just shot an arrow through me that this little girl of nine, I found out she was nine, had already the generosity first to ask for Santa to bring a present for her brother rather than her, and then living in a family that couldn't afford a wagon to please do not forget the poor. Right then and there on the spot, I said, somehow I have to do something for these kids.
This has moved you in a way that you've undertaken, efforts to find Mary and Alfred. And I mentioned that you're celebrating in your house with gifts for children who no longer exist. Why do you do this? What has it said to you?
The generosity of this little girl just hit me so much. I said, I must do something for these kids that I knew probably had passed away 30, 40 years ago. And so I went out and I bought a little Raggedy Ann doll for Mary, and I bought a little dump truck. I couldn't find a hook and ladder with an extensionisting ladder, so I came up with a dump truck. But I did also find a little American Flyer wagon Christmas ornament, so I bought that. And so on Christmas time, I put them under the letters on my mantle.
When you think about their lives in that apartment, obviously poor because of the sentiments that 9-year-old girl is expressing in that letter to Santa, how do you envision their lives in the apartment and around it? What do you think about?
Well, we were able to find out the father passed away in 1904 when he was only 35. His mother came to live with Mary's mother, Esther, and the two kids. And Esther was the breadwinner, being a dressmaker. I did find out from checking census that by 1920 they had moved up to the West 70s, so hopefully they were doing a little bit better by that time.
It seems to me that Mary reminds you of something, of someone. There's something here that's touched you. Who do these kids remind you of? Is it you?
My father passed away when I was young, and my brothers were young. And, it did sort of resonate with me. And so, yeah, that was very astute. I think I maybe made a little connection there. Yeah.
So what do we know about the way that Mary and Alfred lived the rest of their lives and even died?
Alfred became a printer, but the reason that he's been so hard to track down is by the time he was 18, he was going by his middle name, John. But we haven't been able to really find out a lot about him yet. We found out that he passed away in 65. Mary, however, wound up marrying a man by the name of George McGann. It's spelled a little different, but yes, Mary McGann married George McGann. And he was a federal mediator, and apparently she lived a nice, quiet, comfortable life, no children. And just last week, we were able to find where Mary was buried, and I went over to see her, buried a little Christmas tree by her stone. And now that I know where she is, I think every Christmas I'll go visit and say hi.
Well, it's a wonderful story. It's a true life story.
Yeah.
And you've given everyone something really nice at Christmas to connect to in New York and across the country. So we thank you for it. And what a nice find.
They're my two most treasured objects.
Pete Mataliano, acting coach and screenwriter in the Hell's Kitchen section of New York, West 50th Street, former home of Mary and Alfred McGann. Pete, thanks.
Thank you, Todd.
And here's something to take with you today. Chaz Stevens, a secularist blogger and software writer from Deerfield Beach, Florida, is celebrating the season in true Seinfeld fashion this year with a Festivus pole at the Florida State Capitol in Tallahassee. The 6-foot pole is made of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer cans. It's wrapped in rainbow colors, and it stands just down the hall from Governor Rick Scott's office. Stevens also won approval for a Festivus pole display this week in the Oklahoma City Capitol, and he hopes to spread his brand of holiday cheer to Georgia, Illinois, Michigan, and Washington State, too. Someone is going to want to air their grievances for this.
I got a lot of problems with you people.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.